to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Carrie Vaughn. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process, and of course I say others because I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. And normally at this point I would talk more about my latest series, World Shapers from Daw Books, but this is a special month for the World Shapers podcast. I am currently in the throes, as you hear this, which will be on March 15th, the Ides of March. I am currently in the throes of a Kickstarter for an anthology which will feature some of the first year guests of this podcast. People have been very generous, and so I'm going to have, if this funds, I will have brand new fiction from Seanan McGuire, Tanya Huff, David Weber, Elnie Modisett Jr., DJ Butler, Christopher Rocchio, John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, and, oddly enough, me. There will also be some great reprints from John Scalzi, David Brin, Joe Haldeman, Julie Sharnada, Fonda Lee, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Gareth L. Powell, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. So that's going to be a very exciting anthology if I can bring it all together, and that's what this Kickstarter is all about. You can find the Kickstarter at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds, or of course just go to Kickstarter and do a search for Shapers of Worlds. I'm looking to raise $13,500 Canadian. More than half of that will go to pay the authors. I'm paying professional rates. And any stretch goals, if I get above that amount, every $1,500 I get Canadian, I will add another cent a word to what I'm paying the authors. The book itself, once it all comes together, should be available widely in August. But of course, if you're a Kickstarter supporter, you can get a copy of it up front, and you will also get a lot of options when it comes to backers' rewards, some really great ones. Up at the top end, we have, there's a Tuckerization where you can have your name used for a character by Shelley Adina, and she will put that character into the story she's writing for the anthology, which features a flying devices race, although she says the character's survival is not assured. At the $300 level, there are some first readerships from David Weber, where you have the opportunity to get a David Weber novel in manuscript format at the same time as he submits it to his publisher. He will send it out to his first readers. At $250, Julie Sharnada is offering 7 of her most recent audiobooks, 4 full days of science fiction listening, if you chose to binge it that way. I'm offering at $500, I'm offering short story critiques, where I will read up to 7,000 words, do a thorough critique, and have a 1-hour online conversation with you about that. At the very highest level, for $3,000, I am offering a 3-month mentorship, up to 15,000 words a month of some project, detailed critique and commentary, and consultation every 2 weeks, online by Skype or whatever we decide to do. So those are some of the high-end ones, and then there are a number of hardcover books being offered. Fonda Lee is offering some sets of 2 hardcovers of her young adult duology, which begins with EXO, continues with Crossfire, so those are available. DJ Butler is offering a hardcover. Christopher Rocchio has some paperbacks. I'm, of course, offering lots and lots of my books, and Shadowpaw Press books, Shadowpaw Press, my little press, being who will publish this anthology eventually. And then, as I said, of course, there are ebooks and paperback books of the actual anthology available at sort of the basic backer level. So please check out the Kickstarter. It runs through noon on Monday, March 30th, I guess that is, noon Eastern. And at the moment, it is 58% funded, I believe, as of this morning. And we're in that sort of middle part of the campaign where things slow down a bit. I'm hoping to see a surge at the end, but I'd really like to get there long before we get to the end so that we can get some of those stretch goals and pay the authors more. So that's the Shapers of Worlds Kickstarter. I hope that you will check that out. And now let's get on to this episode, which features Carrie Vaughn. Carrie Vaughn's work includes the Philip K. Dick Award-winning novel Bannerless, the New York Times bestselling Kitty Norville urban fantasy series, and over 20 novels and upwards of 100 short stories, two of which have been finalists for the Hugo Award. Her most recent work includes a Kitty spinoff collection, The Immortal Conquistador, which we'll be talking about, and a pair of novellas about Robin Hood's children, The Ghosts of Sherwood and The Heirs of Locksley. She's a contributor to the Wild Card series of shared world superhero books edited by George R. R. Martin and a graduate of the Odyssey Fantasy Writing Workshop. She calls herself a bona fide Air Force brat. Her father served on a B-52 flight crew during the Vietnam War. She grew up all over the U.S., but managed to put down roots in Colorado in the Boulder area, where she pursues an endlessly growing list of hobbies and enjoys the outdoors as much as she can. And it says she is fiercely guarded by a miniature American Eskimo dog named Lily. So welcome to the World Shapers, Carrie.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for being on. I don't believe we've met. I often, when I start this, I'll say, I met you at this convention or that convention, but I don't think we've ever crossed paths to be aware of it anyway.
No, I don't think so. I was guest of honor at a convention in Winnipeg last year, and I think that was my last...
KeyCon.
Yeah, I think that was my last trip north of the border.
I've only been over there to that convention a couple of times, despite it being relatively close. So I wasn't there last year. Well, let's go back into the mists of time, as I like to say, and tell me a bit about your growing up and how you became interested in, I presume you started as a reader, we almost all do, reading and then eventually writing.
I always mention the Air Force brat thing in my bio because it basically explains so much. It's a very concise way of saying that I didn't really grow up in any one place. We moved around a lot. My father was a 20-year career officer, an Air Force Academy graduate. So we lived all over the country. I don't really have a hometown per se. Both my parents are big science fiction fans. They're both big readers. Our bookshelves were filled with Asimov, Heinlein, Clark, all
the big three.
All of the greats from that era that you can think of, Dune, and Hal Clement was one of my mom's favorite authors. So I kind of very quickly moved over to reading what was on their shelves. So I've got a pretty good grounding in what's considered the classic science fiction. And on top of that, we watched Star Trek reruns growing up. It was kind of to the point where I wasn't really aware of anything outside of science fiction until I kind of, got out into the larger world in school and that kind of thing and realized that there were people who didn't read science fiction, and that seemed very odd to me when I realized that was a thing. I had a brief period, a couple of years, where I was all in on horse books, at which point I read all of Marguerite Henry and all of Walter Farley, anything with horses that I could get my hands on. I was pretty steeped in it from a very early age. When I came to write, there was really nothing else I was going to write. It was pretty... How would I put it? Yeah, I grew up in it. That's my world. That's my genre. It's what I love. It's what I'm comfortable with.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Walter Farley. I read all of those books. And there are actually, I like to point out, there are two books, I remember now, the Island Stallion subset, which actually are science fiction. And that came out of left field when I read that for the first time.
The Island Stallion Races is probably one of the most bizarre novels I've ever read. And that's the one where the aliens who bear this very strange resemblance to Abbott and Costello kind of show up and give him a magic bridle so that he can race this wild stallion. And the other one is, what is it? The Ghost of the Black Stallion, the apocalyptic one.
Oh yeah. I think it was the last one Walter Farley wrote.
Yeah, which is completely apocalyptic and has Native American prophecies and falling out of airplanes. And yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I always wished I could have asked Walter Farley, why? Where did that come from? I was just interested that you mentioned it.
Yeah, weird anecdote. I went on a walking tour in San Francisco a few years ago, and the tour guide was Walter Farley's niece, which was super strange because I told at the beginning of the tour, I told the guide that I'm a writer and I'm doing research for a book. So here's the things I'm looking for. And she said, oh, my uncle was a writer. You might have heard of him. And she said, Walter Farley. And of course, I just about melted into a puddle. And what she shared is that he, I think it was his daughter who passed away very suddenly in a car accident, and it affected him very deeply.
Hmm.
And you can sort of see the change that his work gets much darker, at that point. And so that's one answer that I had. I haven't done a lot of reading on it, but
the other
it's kind
thing
of a sad story.
The other thing about Walter Farley, he was one of those people that wrote his, like, the Black Stallion. He was, what, 18 when he wrote it?
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah, so he was one of those real early writers. And, I hate talented young people, but that's just me. So when did you start writing?
So very early. I was lucky that I had a lot of teachers who were big on creative writing assignments. So I officially marked my very first story I wrote when I was 8 years old for a second grade assignment. And you can tell this was my horse period because the story was called Sally the Horse. And it was pretty much a gender flipped retelling of the Black Stallion. Because I had just read The Black Stallion, and there are no girls in The Black Stallion at all.
No, that's true.
So I rewrote it with a girl horse instead of a boy horse. And so that's what I was doing when I was 8 years old, which was sort of a sign of things to come. But yeah, it was 3 pages long, and the teacher said it was the best second grade story she had ever read.
Ooh.
And so that was pretty heady stuff for an 8 year old. So that kind of set me on the path because I got a lot of praise kind of early on for writing when I wasn't really good at anything else. So I kept doing it.
So you kept writing all through your school years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you share your writing with people? I always ask people who started writing young that because I did.
Yes. No, I did a lot. I started submitting stories to magazines when I was 16 is when I sent out. And I was sending them to Analog and Asimov's because, once again, those are what was on my parents' shelves. So that's what I knew about. I was 16, and I got a lot of rejections because I wasn't a very good writer then. I kept on doing it. Especially when I first started kind of breaking into the pro field, people would comment on how young I was, and I would tell them they didn't understand. I had started so young that it felt like I had been doing it for a long time at that point.
So did you study writing or anything like that, or what did you do when you reached university age?
A little bit. My degrees are in literature. And not writing, which surprises people when, I say that I have a master's, a lot of people assume I have an MFA in creative writing, but I don't. I have an MA in literature. I had kind of a bad experience with a creative writing class I took as an undergrad. It was one of these situations that you hear about where, the very first day of class, the professor stood up and said, no science fiction, no fantasy, no genre. There will be no genre in this class. And which, of course, disappointed me terribly. And then I sort of set out on a crusade to prove that science fiction was worthwhile. And I think I succeeded. I had several encounters with this particular professor. And the first was insisting on writing science fiction for this class. And then, for my literature thesis at my senior year, I did things like comparing Le Guin and Shakespeare. I wrote about rites of passage in literature and compared The Farthest Shore to The Tempest, which are both stories about wizards and sorcerers who give up their power and hand it off to the next generation. So I did things like that. I became so determined to bring science fiction into academia. But I never took another college-level creative writing class because I didn't want to have that fight over and over again. And I was already writing. I didn't need, structured space to sit there and write. I was already doing that. So I spent my academic time reading other people and just studying the history of literature and structures and forms and that kind of thing. And then did all my writing on my own. 'Cause it's a hard fight. I think it's a lot easier now than it was, 25 years ago when I was in college.
I've heard similar stories from a lot of writers that they generally, I've rarely, I've spoken to a couple But generally, when they talk about any formal writing classes they took, it was kind of a disappointing or unsuccessful experience for them.
Yeah, and so what I did do is I went to the Odyssey Fantasy Writing Workshop in 1998, mm-hmm. And that's one of the 6 weeks summer workshops. So that's the most kind of structured formal writing experience that I had.
Did you find that the study of literature per se was beneficial to your own writing?
Oh, definitely. I learned things like what is epic literature. From a historical perspective, what is epic literature? And you can trace, the lines from, the Iliad and the Odyssey to the Aeneid to, Dante's Inferno, the Divine Comedy up through the Faerie Queen and Paradise Lost, Milton's Paradise Lost. And you can trace this line of what is sort of the formal structure of epic, because there is, a formal literary definition of epic and how can you draw on that? How does that apply to, modern fantasy? We throw around the word epic in modern fantasy, but what does that really mean? And how can we use that? How can you use that history to kind of understand what makes modern epic fantasy tick? The differences between epic and sword and sorcery, all of this critical structure exists, in speaking about literature, and why can't we use that to talk about genre as well? So there's just a lot of insights there. The division between genre and non-genre literature is relatively recent. Only in the last 100 years or so has there been this divide between commercial and literary and these different serious and not serious, commercial, academic, whatever. But you go back 100 years, and my favorite example of this is Joseph Conrad, who's a great writer, is one of my favorite writers, just stylistically. So there's a lot to learn, just on a prose level. But he's considered a very serious literary writer now, and there's those aspects of him. But when he was publishing, he was in kind of the same magazines as Arthur Conan Doyle. He was, pursuing kind of that same career, and then you read him side by side with somebody like H. Rider Haggard. Of course, stylistically he's a better writer than H. Rider Haggard, but they're essentially kind of writing in the same mode, and for me that was revelatory, that Joseph Conrad was writing these boys' adventure stories set in the colonies, the Victorian English colonial setting, just doing it very differently, and so that was very useful for me to think about, writers who we now consider serious were not necessarily that when they were publishing. And I often, because of my academic background, I often get on these literary versus genre panels, and I always start out by kind of destroying everybody by pointing out there's really only two categories of literature. There are the books that people are still reading in 50 years and the books people are not still reading in 50 years. And most of us will fall into that latter category. Most of us will not still be read in 50 years, literary genre, whatever. If a book has lasted that long, it's just a classic. And that's all there is.
Yeah, it's always interesting to look at, bestseller list from say the 1920s or something and see how few of those books you've ever even heard of, even though
exactly.
they were big things at the time.
Yeah.
And then the people who, for example, try to would prefer that Lord of the Rings not somehow be considered lasting literature, and it just keeps going and going. So.
Well, I worked in a bookstore for a few years, and it's really interesting to watch which books are sort of making that transition. Like Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury is well on its way to transitioning kind of into that classic category. Another one, especially in the science fiction world and in the genre world, we sort of talk about like the classic era, the science fiction of the 50s and the 60s and all the greats. But what's really fascinating is you pick up the anthologies and the magazines from that era, and dozens of writers who we don't hear about anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same. There are certain commentators who would like to think that, well, science fiction was universally so much better back then. But it's sort of the same ratio. You take an anthology from about 10 years ago, 20, 40, 50 years ago. And you'll recognize a couple of names and the rest, not so much.
I suppose it's a form of Sturgeon's Law there.
It absolutely is, and it applies to everything. It's across the board.
Were you aiming for an academic career? Getting a master's, I would kind of assume so.
Not originally, not really. I had sort of, you know, there are so many people who write who have an academic career as their day job. And so I had thought for a while that I would try to follow that path. And discovered I didn't like academia. And that was part of me getting the master's, was trying to decide if I could live in academia, if I could make a living there, make a career there. And I decided it wasn't for me. I don't like specializing. Like, I would have had to specialize if I went on for a PhD, and I couldn't pick a topic. I like studying everything. You know, my sort of critical approaches were were not fashionable. You know, I was actually just reading somebody talking about how you're discouraged from being emotional in academia, and I would always come into, you know, my commentary, you know, come into my analyses with, I really love this, and here's why. You know, I couldn't separate the emotion out of it. And the PhD candidates just looked so tired all the time and just exhausted, and it didn't look like very much fun. So I ended up not going on past the master's.
Well, you were writing all this time. Had you started to sell while you were in university, or when did that all happen for you?
I did. I made my first sales when I was at the University of Colorado working on my master's degree. You know, in fact, I went to Odyssey. I quit my job and I went to Odyssey, and then I started grad school that same fall. So yeah, I was writing and submitting the entire time. I was working on my first couple of novels. So that's another thing. I was definitely not totally committed to academia there, because I was working on all of this creative writing on the side. But yeah, I made my first couple of sales while I was working on my master's. Sold my first novel a couple of years after that. I had a day job working in an accounting office. Yeah, and I just kept plugging away at it.
And you've, at this point, written an awful lot of short stories, and yet you also write novels. There are some authors that seem to, you know, they either think of themselves as novelists or short story writers, but you seem to be both.
Yeah, and I've been really grateful that I've been able to continue writing short stories, because the usual pattern, you know, science fiction is kind of unique that we do have a really robust short story market. You know, lots of places to sort of publish and read short stories, which isn't true for other genres. Or even necessarily literary fiction in some ways. But I've been really grateful that I've been able to keep doing it, because you break in short stories. That's kind of the conventional wisdom. You make a name writing short stories, and then you start writing novels. And yeah, a lot of you move into novels, and a lot of writers stop writing short stories. You know, on the one hand, there's the economic factor, that there's just not a lot of money in writing short stories. For me, it turns out writing short stories is kind of part of my novel writing process. I get stuck when I write novels. You know, I'll be plugging away, and then I'll get to a point where I lose track of the plot, or it's not going well. So I stop and I take a break, and I usually write a short story. You know, I'll take a couple weeks and write a short story, and then go back to the novel. You know, letting my hindbrain kind of noodle around on the novel, you know, whatever problem has stuck. And if I take a break and go back to it, I can usually get unstuck. And in the meantime, I've got a couple of short stories that I've been working on. So I think because of that, I've been able to keep doing both, you know, to a degree that it's kind of nice. You know, it's nice. Not every writer does that. So I've been pretty happy that I've been able to keep doing that.
Yeah, I always thought I would be a short story writer to start with, because that's what we were told when I was starting and writing science fiction, that you started with short stories. And yet I recently put out a collection of my short fiction, and I had to scrape everything I'd ever had published to make a book out of it, because there just aren't that many of them. So, yeah, it's interesting. So turning to the novel, was that Kitty in the Midnight Hour? Was that your first novel?
Yep. So, my first published novel.
Yeah.
I have three. I tried to sell three novels that did not sell. And I stopped shopping those around, because each one that I wrote was better than the one before. So I would trunk the one that wasn't as good, and then I would write a new one. and then trunk that because the next one was better. So Kidding the Midnight Hour was the fourth novel that I wrote, but it was the first one that sold.
And interestingly, the book we're going to focus on, we talk about your creative process here in a minute, is the final complete tale in the series.
You know, I don't like the word final.
It's what it says in the description.
Yeah. It's because I've kept writing short stories kind of set in that world, and I don't know where it's all going to go. You know, the novels about Kitty are done. But yeah, I keep finding stories to tell about the other characters. So yeah, I'll probably keep doing spinoffs. So we're talking about the Immortal Conquistador, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's stories that are all about Rick, who's the main vampire character in the Kitty series. Half of it's reprints and half of it's new.
So let's go back and talk about Kitty. You're a werewolf talk show host. Mm-hmm. What was the genesis of Kitty Norville?
Okay. So we have to go back to when I was working in the bookstore. There was a book by Laura Schlesinger called 10 Stupid Things Women Do to Mess Up Their Lives. I hated that book with a passion. mostly because a lot of the people who bought it were middle-aged and older men buying it to give to their daughters and granddaughters. And it drove me bananas that they would think that this was a good idea, that they would basically send the message to their daughters and granddaughters, hey, I think you're going to screw up. Hey, you know, you're going to have problems. Hey, women mess up their lives, and I think you're going to mess up your life. And one big lesson I learned in the bookstore is just don't give self-help books as presents, as gifts. It's actually very popular to do, and I don't understand it.
Because you're basically saying, well, you're a mess. See if this helps.
Hey, I think you're a mess. Here you go. Hey, I think you screwed up. Here you go. And it can sometimes go very badly when you do that. So I decided, this was also when Buffy the Vampire Slayer was on the air, And I decided that Dr. Laura and Dr. Phil and all of those call-in radio advice shows that were so popular in the late 90s, they would not know what to do with vampires and werewolves and their problems. If Buffy called in to Dr. Laura to explain her love triangles, Dr. Laura would just not know what to do. So, of course, they need their own talk radio advice show that's especially dedicated to the problems of the supernatural world. So that's the idea. That's where the whole thing started. And from there, it was a process of making decisions. Well, if I'm going to have a talk radio advice show, I need a host. I need the main character. I decided she couldn't be human because she wouldn't have any credibility talking about the supernatural world. I didn't make her a vampire because I was kind of tired of vampires at the time, but there just wasn't a whole lot with werewolves out there. At the time, this was the late 90s, the early aughts, there really wasn't anything with a werewolf main character that wasn't completely horror and tragic, American Werewolf in London.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of, tragic story of angst and bloodlust and all of that. So that's how that started it started with the radio show. I made my host a werewolf because it sounded interesting and it was different. And then I named her Kitty because that was just funny.
And it worked.
I hope so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there were how many novels in the series? Was it 14?
There were 14 novels in the series. Yeah.
I was reading a bit. This is on Wikipedia, so hopefully it's accurate. There was a quote there about becoming popular with romance readers, that it was kind of like Jerry Lewis becoming popular in France. Was it a surprise to you?
No. Especially in hindsight, looking what was going on, because there was this entire movement. This was the whole urban fantasy explosion. Mm-hmm. That happened in kind of the mid-aughts, and then went on for the next 10 years. And part of the reason that genre took off so much is because of the crossover with romance readers. So what surprised me is that my publisher marketed the series so hard at romance readers, because if you've read Kitty and the Midnight Hour, if you've read the series, there's really not a whole lot of romance. You know, it doesn't follow the romance formula where she meets a guy and they fall in love and they have obstacles and they get together. They're not together. Oh, they are together. And happily ever after. Like, this was where, you know, somebody wrote a review of it early on that said no HEA. And I had to look up what HEA meant. And in the romance world, that's happily ever after.
Yeah, apparently they're supposed to have happy endings in romance novels.
Yes, yes. And that was one of the interesting things about urban fantasy, is because it followed a lot of the romance tropes, but most of them don't have happily ever afters. And it's my own theory that's the reason the term urban fantasy kind of got co-opted for this as opposed to paranormal romance. So even though the genre had a lot in common with paranormal romance tends to have the happily ever after, and urban fantasy doesn't.
Yeah, one of the people I talked to is a paranormal romance writer, mm-hmm. and that's what she made that point, that she had to have a happy ending.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The pattern that paranormal romance follows is that you have a whole group of people, and then each book will follow a different couple, so that you can have that happy ending. And urban fantasy doesn't do that. And yet, a lot of romance writers like urban fantasy because they get a lot of the same things. They get that strong central woman character. You know, there is a lot of kind of romantic subplots. You know, there's a lot of sex in some of the books. Yeah, so there's a lot of similarities, but it is missing a couple of the key components. So I didn't know that when Kitty and the Midnight Hour first came out, but I learned a lot about that and why that crossover worked so well. But that's one of the reasons urban fantasy was so popular, because it appealed to so many different kinds of readers.
Did you have a series in mind when you started it, or did it grow, just kind of grow?
It grew. So growing up in science fiction, you know that every book can have a sequel. You know, there's always the potential for the sequel. And especially, you know, growing up as an aspiring writer, at the time in particular, you know, you would be offered multi-book contracts. You know, here's your two-book contract. Can you write a sequel? And, you know, when you're an aspiring writer being offered your first contract and they ask, can you write a sequel? The answer is always yes.
Yes.
So I sold Kitty and the Midnight Hour, and I wrote it as a standalone because none of my other novels had sold, so why should that one sell? So I was sort of not expecting it to sell, but I did have an idea. I would be able to say yes if they offered, if they wanted a sequel. And then they offered me another contract with another sequel, and then another one. And then the next one was for 3 books, and then the next one was for 4 books. So at that point, it was writing 3 and 4, I realized that this could become a long ongoing series if I wanted it to. And I was able to do that because I had a lot of ideas. You know, once you sort of start with what would the world look like if vampires and werewolves were real? What would this look like if the supernatural was real? You know, there would be congressional hearings. You know, the army would make use of werewolves. What about this? What about reality TV? What about, what about Las Vegas? What does Las Vegas look like with vampires? And it just kind of keeps going on and on and on. And I always had ideas that didn't fit in whatever book I was writing at the time, so I could always move those over to the next book. And I kept that going. That lasted me for a good long while. And it's around book 4 that I started planting seeds for the ongoing storyline that would last, for the whole series, is when I realized that, yeah, I needed to start kind of planting some things so that I could have this overarching storyline.
Well, you talked about having all these ideas. Of course, this is for a series, so the big idea was the werewolf talk show host.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've written a ton of short stories and other novels as well. What is kind of generally, where do these seeds of stories come from for you?
Everywhere. We joke writers hate that question, you know, where you get your ideas.
And but I ask it anyway.
But it's a valid idea. And I think what a lot of people want to know is, like, A, where did you get this specific idea for that specific thing? But also, it's a process question. But the reason I think it is kind of hard to answer and baffling for some of us is that the ideas are just everywhere. And I have so many more ideas than I'll ever be able to write. And you know, trying to find a specific, you know, genesis, because it is different for almost every story. I wrote my YA novel, Steel, because the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie made me so angry. that I wanted to write my own pirate book. You know, gosh, what else? You know, sometimes it'll start with a song that just inspires an image and inspires a feeling, and I want to write something to capture that. You know, Rick kind of was me pushing back against a lot of vampire tropes. You know, I wanted to write a vampire who was different, who didn't really buy into, you know, kind of the vampire politics thing that was really popular kind of through the 90s and you know, on up until today. So, you know, I wrote this character who was kind of independent and kind of good. You know, he wanted to do good in the world. I have written a lot because of things that make me angry. You know, I'll read a book or see a TV show and think I can do that a whole lot better, and then set out to do that. You know, some of my stories have happened very quickly. Some of them have taken years to kind of cook and develop. You know, for The Ghosts of Sherwood, that's coming out in June, I had the initial idea of that for like 15 years ago. And I kind of wrote it down and tucked it in a folder and couldn't quite make it work. You know, I originally thought it was going to be a YA novel, and just I couldn't pull it together for that. And then last year, I saw a couple of versions of Robin Hood that didn't make me happy. And then I went back to a version of Robin Hood that did make me happy, and started thinking a lot about, well, what makes a good Robin Hood story? What doesn't make a good Robin Hood story? And I pulled that old idea and was able to finally kind of pull it together into a story, the novella length. You know, it's not the YA novel I thought it was going to be. It's a novella now. But I wrote it and a sequel, because I can always write a sequel. So yeah, sometimes it's very quick and sometimes it takes a long time. I watched a lot of Jane Austen while I was writing the Kiddie novels, you know, the Jane Austen movies from the BBC, mm-hmm. and started thinking, what would werewolves look like in Regency England? And I've gotten a couple of short stories out of that idea. And I'm hoping to do more. So yeah, I it's a lot easier to answer, where did you get the specific idea for this thing? But because in general, you know, they're everywhere.
So once you have an idea, what does your planning process look like? Do you do a detailed outline, or how does it work for you?
I kind of just think about it for a long time. I'll start writing notes. I may try to write the beginning just to get a feel of the voice that I want. You know, voice and tone, I think, are really big. And a lot of times I can't actually start writing until I nail down, you know, what's the voice, who's the viewpoint character, what's the conflict, and where does it end? I don't necessarily do detailed outlines. I kind of wish I did, but it never works. I sit down to write a detailed outline and think that I have it, and then I'll go to write the story, and I will always, always get to a point in the outline where it says something awesome happens here. But I have not described what the awesome thing is. And that's generally where I have to stop and reassess the entire project. I try to get the ending nailed down so that I know where I'm going. And who the main characters are and what the tone. You know, is it going to be, you know, an uplifting story? Is it going to be a tragedy? Is it going to be snarky? Is it going to be serious? And sometimes that just takes noodling around with notes and kind of some brainstorming.
Tend to be a long process, or do you do that fairly quickly before you're ready to start writing?
I do that fairly quickly. It depends on how long I've been thinking about the story. Like Sinew and Steel, the short story that just came out on Tor.com, was very quick. You know, I think I wrote the whole thing in like 2 days. Now, I should also mention, I do a lot of revising, so my first drafts are always kind of rough.
Well, that'll be my next question.
yeah. You know, so I wrote the story very quickly, but the ideas in it I had been thinking about for a long time. And the world that story is kind of set in is... I have a space opera kind of world that I've been noodling around with for a long time, and I've set other short stories kind of in that same general world. So on the one hand, you know, I didn't have to do a lot of work with the world building and things like that because I already had a pretty good idea in my head. It was just, the characters' relationships were kind of what had to come together before I could actually write the story.
What does your actual writing process look like? I mean, physically, do you work at home? Do you go out to a coffee shop? Do you use a quill pen under a tree on a piece of parchment? How
no,
do you write?
No, I work at home on the computer, typing generally. I will often do outlining and brainstorming and, you know, kind of getting out of ruts and things with pen and paper on the sofa. And that's one of my writer's block coping mechanisms. And we can talk about writer's block too. I know some writers think it doesn't exist, but for me, it's if I'm blocked, it's because I made a mistake and the story has gone off the rails and I have to stop and back up and figure out what went wrong. And I will often get away from the computer for that because that's part of the problem. You know, if I find myself sitting and staring at the computer and picking up my phone and scrolling through social media and not actually writing or not knowing what comes next or dreading opening up the file, you know, those are all signs that something has gone wrong. So I'll step away from that and try to give myself a new perspective. But generally, I'm at the computer at the desk.
Yeah, that I used to say that I didn't get writer's block because I was a newspaper reporter and a weekly newspaper reporter, and I cranked up thousands of words every week. And, you know, you had a deadline and you couldn't miss it. But on the most recent thing, I've got my third book in my series. It's coming out from Daw this fall, which actually has werewolves and vampires in it, by the way.
Oh, very nice.
Called The Moonlit World. I got about halfway in and I just stalled. And what I had to do was back up and edit so that I hit it running and I suddenly was able to see what the problem was. But yeah, that's my form of writer's block too. It's just, I did something wrong. This just isn't working.
So. Yeah. It's, you know, at what point did things start to not feel right?
Once you have a draft, you just said that, well, first of all, are you a fast writer then when things are ticking along or a slow writer?
Yes. Well, it depends on how you define fast and slow. And what I have discovered is it's all very contextual. On a day-to-day basis, I don't seem like a fast writer. So like a lot of writers talk about writing every day, and I really hate on social media when writers post their word counts, their daily word counts. And I know it's very helpful for some people as a form of accountability.
I do it to brag if I've been really productive. Otherwise,
well,
I don't.
And that's part of the problem is that, you know, I'll see somebody post like, oh, I had a really slow day today. I only wrote 3,500 words. I know I can do better. And I'm sitting here with like feeling really good about the 800 words that I managed.
Yeah.
Like my daily word count, if I can get past 500 words, I'm happy. I generally do 1,000 words a day, but 500 words, I have a friend, the short story writer and novelist, James Van Pelt, who's just a fantastic writer. He often has stories in Asimov's and Analog. He's an everyday writer. 250 words is his limit, and that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a page. It's a double-spaced manuscript page. And if you do that every day for a year, you'll have a novel at the end of it. So, you know, I look at my daily word count and it's like 500, 800, you know, a really good day, I'll maybe do 1,500 words. I had a 4,000 word day a couple of weeks ago. I will have one of those a year. And yet, I basically write a novel in a half a year. Like the novel I'm currently working on, I'm closing in on 90,000 words. And I started it in November. So that's only 4 or 5 months to write a draft. So that's very fast. So while my daily word count is quite low, I'm still able to write a novel or two a year, which is very fast by some standards. So
you can't get them published much faster than that. So you can't get them published much faster than that.
Yeah,
a novel or two a year.
You know, my low daily word count still produces a lot. And one of the things I've learned is the people who produce like those outrageously high daily word counts, they're not doing that every day. They're doing that for 2 weeks, and then they're not writing for 4 weeks after that because it's really hard. You know, it's really hard to maintain that pace. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think we're all kind of producing around the same amount. But by most standards, I'm prolific. But I don't know how fast I actually am. And, you know, I can write a novel manuscript in 4 or 5 months, but then I'll have to spend a couple months revising it a lot.
Yeah, and that was the next thing.
Usually 2 or 3 drafts, yeah.
You said you do a lot of revision, so what does that look like for you? What sorts of things do you find that you have to work on as you go through those multiple revisions?
Oh, it's kind of different for every book and every story.
Do you give it a rest first before you?
I do. I try. Yeah. If I have time, if I'm not on a deadline, I try to get a beta reader or two to look at it. A lot of times it's just making sure I've maximized the story structure, that I've maximized the conflict, that things are clear, that things make sense, that I haven't missed opportunities to kind of really pump up the story, that I've started in the right place, that it wouldn't be better if I started at a different point in the story. Cutting out exposition, a lot of times, as you're writing, in a first draft, I'll be explaining the story to myself, and sometimes those sections need to go because they're too expository and they're not very illuminating for the reader, it turns out. It might have been helpful and I might have needed to do it to get the story straight in my own mind, but a lot of times those sections just aren't necessary. It's a lot of it is about just maximizing, making sure I know what the story is about, making sure that what I want the reader to get out of it is actually conveyed in the manuscript.
You mentioned beta readers. Do you use the same people all the time, or how does that work?
Generally, lately, yeah. My agent will often do a first pass. I have some writer friends who I've known for years and years, and we basically exchange manuscripts whenever we need an extra set of eyes on something.
And once you have your version that you're satisfied with and it goes to the editor, what kind of editorial feedback do you typically get?
Kind of the same kinds of things. Editors will always see something that I missed or that I just didn't think about. Sometimes I'll push back. Like sometimes they'll have an idea that pushes the story in a direction that maybe isn't where I want it to go. Mm-hmm. But then my job is to look at what do I need to do then to clarify the story that I want to tell, because obviously if they're responding to something that isn't clear, like the novel I'm working on now with my editor, the one that is under contract, he came up with this kind of long, complicated idea to fill out the characters' backstories that I didn't like his idea. Because I felt like it drew emphasis away from what I wanted the story to be about. But I still had to respond to what he was basically addressing, which was the backstories of the characters weren't fleshed out. So at that point, it doesn't matter the details, but I do need to do something to flesh out the background, because obviously there's something missing there if he was responding that strongly to it. So I think it's Neil Gaiman who had the quote, if somebody tells you that something is wrong with your manuscript, they're almost always right. But when they offer a solution, they're almost always wrong. And that's just because so it's so important to have a good idea of the story that you want to tell. I've seen manuscripts that have gone through workshops and things, and the author will try to make everybody happy and they'll try to incorporate everybody's suggestions. And it just ends up looking like a mess after, it's all over the place at that point, which is why, an author, you really have to have a good idea of what you intended, what you want the reader to get out of it, what your story looks like, so that you can sort of, incorporate or reject, your beta reader suggestions. Because a lot of times, they're responding to something. They may not, their solution probably isn't going to work for you, but dig under that to see what they're responding to.
Yeah, it's. I'm currently writer in residence at the Saskatoon Public Library, and I worry sometimes about, I'm trying to tell people how I think they can make things better. But at the same time, as a writer, you have to hold firmly onto your vision of the story and not be influenced just because some, authority figure is telling you maybe it might be better some other way. Even if I think I'm completely right, it's still their story.
Well, yeah. I learned this at the Odyssey workshop, which was great because you're there for 6 weeks. You're getting a different story critiqued every week. So you sort of start to learn these things. And I could kind of start to figure out my own responses. That we'd go around the circle and people would critique things and they'd say things and say, well, this is what I got out of your story. And I'd be sitting there thinking, well, that's not what I meant. Well, that's not what I meant. That's wrong. And then you have to take a step back from that and say, well, no, they're telling you what their response is, and that's correct. So at that point, I have to look at the story and say, okay, what in the story signaled them wrong? they got something out of the story I didn't intend. So now I have to go back to the story and look at what where they got that signal. And that's what I have to fix. You know, I don't necessarily have to listen to them, but I do have to say, okay, they got something out of there I didn't intend. What's in the story that I didn't see? And I found that's one of the hardest things for people to learn is to look at their story completely objectively, you know, to really look at the words on the page and not what you intended. And I find this is really common. I do critiques now for the Odyssey Critique Service. And, you know, there are times where I can tell it's like, okay, I think this person is not actually looking at the words on the page and they don't see what I'm seeing. You know, they're reading the page, but they're seeing the story in their head because they're so familiar with the story in their head that that's what they're seeing. And they haven't really actually looked at the words on the page. And I know that's kind of a vague and nebulous thing, but I think it's hard for us sometimes to really learn to look at the words that we have written and to think about what they're actually saying versus what we think they're saying. Because sometimes those don't match up. And then it's a hard thing to learn, but I think it's so important if you want to make that jump into, you know, making sales and getting published.
Yeah, it's something I've said quite often to the writers I'm working with is that you have a very clear idea of what's going on, but you are not conveying it to the reader. So mm-hmm. you have to be able to do that. Well, let's talk a little bit about Immortal Conquistador. That's the collection of Rick stories.
Yeah.
When did Rick show up in the series? Is he in the first book or coming along
later?
He's
in the very first book. Yeah, he's in the very first book. In fact, he was in the very first short story, in the first draft of the first short story that never got published. So yeah, there was a kiddie short story that was published in Weird Tales a few years before the first novel came out. But in my very first draft, Rick was there. So Rick he's there almost from the moment, you know, I had the whole idea for the character. I ended up cutting him out of the original short story because it was too long and complicated, but he definitely came back for for Kitty and the Midnight Hour. And then he's kind of ubiquitous. I think he's in almost every single book, except for maybe, you know, maybe three or four of them that he's not in. So yeah, he's there. He becomes the master vampire of Denver over the course of the series. And he's one of Kitty's strongest allies, so he's a pretty important figure.
And the Immortal Conquistador is a collection of stories about him. Does it deal mostly with his backstory?
Yes.
His ancient past?
Yeah.
I gathered from the title.
Yeah, well, that's... It's one of the fun things about, I've written a lot of short stories set in the world because the novels are all first person point of view, which means I can only talk about what Kitty mm-hmm. knows. And it turns out nobody tells her anything. Like there's so many things she doesn't know. And one of the things she doesn't know is the backstories of all the side characters. So I ended up writing kind of origin stories for a lot of the characters, you know, spin-off stories, just things. And a lot of those stories were so that I would know. You know, what the character's backstory was. But Rick drops hints all the way through the series about his background, and then he doesn't tell Kitty anything. So we get this hint pretty early on that he was part of Coronado's company when he made his expedition north out of colonial Mexico, which of course is like a huge bomb to drop on somebody and not explain. But then I wrote the story, and that story includes how he became a vampire in colonial Mexico. So he's 500 years old, and he's lived in the Southwest and the Rocky Mountain West almost that entire time. And it's kind of endless. Like, I could write an almost endless number of stories about him if I wanted to. You know, another story in the collection, he drops a hint to Kitty that he met Doc Holliday. And Kitty, of course, Kitty demands to know the details, and he won't tell her because he doesn't tell her anything. But then I had to go and write the story because I wanted to know how he met Doc Holliday and what happened there.
So it sounds like a fun collection.
I hope so, yeah. And like the Doc Holliday story appeared in Asimov Science Fiction a couple of years ago. The Conquistador story and the second story after that, Hidalgo de la Noche, were were all previously published, but there's a novella that kind of makes up the second half of it that's all new, that sort of explains what happened to Rick after some events later on in the series.
So that's Immortal Conquistador. Who published it?
It's Tachyon.
Oh, that's right. I knew that.
Yeah, Tachyon Publications, yep.
Because Tachyon is who put me in touch with you. That's right. I remember that now. So we're getting close to the end of my hour here, so I want to ask my big philosophical question, which is, why do you write? Why do you think any of us write? And why do you write this stuff?
Well, because that's what's going on in my head. I write because I'd go a little bit crazy if I didn't, because I've got all of this.
I hear that a lot.
Stuff. You know, and I'm not sure I'm happy with that answer, because it's a little bit facile. You know, it's kind of easy. It's like, well, maybe I'd be a knitter. You know, I knit for fun, but maybe I would be like this massive hardcore knitter if I wasn't writing. You know, I started writing because it really was something I was good at as a kid that I got a lot of praise for. So I put a lot of energy into it as a kid. So at this point, it's like, well, I write because I've been doing it my whole life, because it's where a huge set of my, you know, a lot of my energy and it's the skill I developed over all of this time. So, you know, that there's, I don't know if this is a facetious answer, but I write because I've been doing it almost my whole life, and I don't know what I would do if I didn't write. But it's also because, you know, I write because I've had all these stories in my head. You know, I write science fiction and fantasy because it's what makes me happy, you know, because it's the genre I grew up with. I think it's a genre of endless possibilities. You know, everything I want to write just about can be contained in it. Although I'm moving more and more into historical fiction, which I'm sort of curious about. I haven't thought about that too much, but in a lot of ways, you know, just in terms of how we write it, historical fiction and science fiction and fantasy have a lot of overlap. You know, they're very similar in approaches, I think, because you're imagining a world that you don't live in.
And you have to explain it to the reader.
Yeah. So there's a lot of similarities there. So yeah, you know, part of it is I love thinking about worlds that aren't this one. And I've got a lot of stories to tell.
Well, this podcast is called The World Shapers. Very few books actually shape the world, but what do you hope your readers take from it? Are you shaping them in some way, do you think?
I hope so. I've actually gotten some very poignant responses from readers. And the takeaway from that is, you never know what is going to impact somebody and when. You never know if your book is going to be the thing that gets somebody through a hard time. You don't know. So we all have to write kind of the best, most honest stories that we can. You know, we do have to put our hearts into everything, because I think that's what people respond to. And you just never know. Like, I don't purposefully set out to entertain people. You know, I want people to read my books and be entertained and to be happy. You know, I want them to feel like I did when I read my favorite books. But sometimes that book is the thing that gets somebody through the day. And that's a really powerful thing that I'm still grappling with.
And what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a lot of things. I'm always working on a lot of things. So there's all the books coming out this year. So The Immortal Conquistador will be out in about a week. The Ghosts of Sherwood and The Heirs of Loxley will be out this summer. Another Kitty collection, Kitty's Mixtape, will be out in the fall. And I'm working on two different novels right now, neither one of whom we've really settled on the titles, but the one that will be coming out first, probably sometime next year, is this strange kind of gaming nerds gone wild, that I need to come up with a better way to explain this. There's an island.
Sounds like a great title to me.
Well, yeah, gaming nerds gone wild. Yeah, there's an island that an eccentric billionaire has been building. He's setting out to prove that sufficiently advanced technology really is indistinguishable from magic. And he's doing it on this island, and the island staff has mutinied. And my character is part of a team of mercenaries that is sent in to figure out what went wrong. So it's kind of science fiction, but it's also kind of fantasy, and it's also kind of about gaming. And as soon as I get a title, I will tell people what it is. We're kind of doing the brainstorming the title thing. And I'm also working on a fantasy novel right now set in the Neolithic Ireland.
Oh, cool. And where can people find you online?
CarrieVaughn.com.
That's easy. CarrieVaughn.com. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the World Shapers. That was a fun chat. I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
And, best of luck with the Immortal Conquistador and all that other stuff you're working on.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks again to Carrie Vaughn for that great chat. I enjoyed it. I hope you did, too. Just a reminder that this is a kind of a special month for Shapers of Worlds, that I am running a Kickstarter. I talked about it at the top, so I won't give you a great detail now, but just a reminder, there's lots of great authors involved, and I would love to have you help me make that anthology a reality by supporting the Kickstarter, which you can find at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds, or you can simply go to Kickstarter and do a search for Shapers of Worlds. Just a reminder as well that you can find the World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com, that you can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, two T's on Willett there too. Funny that. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. And technically, I have like an Instagram account and a couple of things like that, but I'm not very good about those, so I won't bother with those. Looking ahead on this podcast, just a week from when this one goes live, because of the Kickstarter, I'm doing them once a week instead of every 2 weeks. The great Tim Powers will be my guest on the episode that will come out next weekend, or the weekend of March 21st, 22nd. And the week after that, it will be Ira Naiman. I just interviewed S.M. Sterling. I have Barbara Hambly coming up, Adria Laycroft, and I'm sure I'm forgetting someone, but some other great interviews in the works. And I hope that you will continue to come back and listen to all of these conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. Bye for now.